and you're on the front porch, where we talk about the tough issues facing Appalachia the same way you and your friends do on your front porch. Should marriage be banned for teenagers? And also, when teenagers want to leave the nest, there's a struggle to stay, and also sometimes there's a struggle to leave. We're going to go into the story of Mark Combs, part of our Struggle to Stay series. Support for The Front Porch comes from the Charleston Gazette-Mail, using its CGM app to deliver news, traffic, sports, and more. Download it today at iTunes or Google Play. I'm Scott Finn, Supreme Leader of West Virginia Public Broadcasting, joined as always by Twitter's answer to Xena the Warrior Princess, Lori Lynn. Hey, Lori.
Hi, Scott.
And our hillbilly philosopher, Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee.
Hi, Scott. Are you the dear leader or the great leader? Which?
Supreme Leader.
Supreme Leader. Okay.
Yeah, get that straight.
Okay.
So there's a set of proposals going around that would ban marriage for people under the age of 18. Lori, you've been looking into this and what's going on, and then what's your opinion about it?
Well, Nick Kristof had a column in the New York Times. He cited some really egregious examples of, you know, I think he led off with an 11-year-old girl in Florida who was pregnant, and there was some kind of religious situation, and she married the father of the baby, who was much older. A clerk in Florida signed a marriage license for an 11-year-old. It had her birthday on it. They knew that she was 11.
Was that legal?
It is legal. In a lot of states, there's no minimum age as long as your parents approve, and often a court has to approve. So a lot of times you have to have a judge actually sign off on it. So there's a national movement to ban marriage under 18. And I think New York is maybe about to do this. New Jersey has come pretty close. What do I think about it? You know, obviously, an 11-year-old girl should not be getting married, right? But I do think a 17-year-old should probably be allowed to marry, probably with parental permission. So I think the idea of banning it under 18 is a pretty blunt instrument to get at the really, really abusive situations. And I think it's kind of a cultural thing, you know? We talked a lot about kind of the urban-rural divide. I think this is a little bit of, I mean, I don't know. What do you guys think? I knew people in high school who got pregnant and got married, and it worked out. You know, I think the statistic is 70% of these marriages fail, which is about what you would expect. But that means 30% don't. And, you know, honestly, a lot of marriages between 20 and 30-year-olds fail. So I don't know that that statistic is enough to make me think it should be banned.
Think about what you can and cannot do at 18 or even 21. So you have a situation where you could get married with your parents' permission at 16 and all those responsibilities that go along with it, and you still can't drink. In some states, you might not be able to drive yet. And in, you know, Appalachia, there's a history of people marrying relatively young.
Well, all of us, if we look back, you know, you don't have to go back far in your ancestry to find people who married in their teens.
My grandma got married at 16.
Sure. And that doesn't mean that we should be doing it today necessarily, but it certainly was the common, and, you know, everyone did it 100, 200 years ago, certainly.
I personally don't believe anyone should be allowed to get married until they're 1 year older than what I am at any given moment. So, you know, I do have a Bible verse for this one, which is at 1 Corinthians, Paul said, it is better to marry than to burn. But he never married, and I don't think he knew what he was necessarily talking about there.
But to expound on that seriously, a lot of these people promoting, you know, this restriction would be completely fine with a 17-year-old having sex, right? They're not prudes about the sex part. And they would also be perfectly fine with that 17-year-old having an abortion. In a lot of cases, they would say she shouldn't have to have her parents' permission to have an abortion. But then they would say, but no, she can't legally marry the father of her child. And that's a cultural thing, right? There are lots of communities in the U.S. where if a daughter gets pregnant at, say, 16 or 17, the parents are going to want to have her be married. And that's an important thing. And what essentially, you know, the elites would be saying is, no, she can have sex, she can have an abortion, which may be very contrary to your values, but she cannot marry the father of that child. And, you know, you should also say you can't control what people do on a religious level, right? The 11-year-old still could have had a, you know, marriage ceremony. It might not have been a legal marriage, but you can't control what goes on there.
I would at the very least want somebody like a judge to sign off on a teen marriage to make sure that the teen isn't being coerced into being married. I think it's possible to know your mind at 16, but I don't think it necessarily is so.
Well, the brain doesn't really finish developing until, in the 20s or something. One thing I really think
if people,
until it starts to decline. so we never quite get there. But one thing I really think, if people really, you hear all this talk about strengthening marriage. I think if you really want to do that, it's good to encourage people to delay it until they're stable, until they have more of a sense of who they are.
Until they've got education.
I think early marriages are a high risk.
Yeah.
I didn't say coerce. I just said encourage.
Well, I don't know. Word. I think we might have gone too far. I think Lori and I are in sync here. I think we've gone too far in the other direction. People are so worried about being ready for marriage now. And worse than that, it's not even about being educated. A lot of times it's about having enough money for a big wedding ceremony.
Oh, that's screwed up. Yeah, I'm totally
And there are actual, liberal, public ad campaigns directed at the opposite of that. For example, when I was living in D.C., there were ads very specifically kind of targeting the African-American community saying you don't have to have your life together to get married, meaning you don't have to have your degree. You don't have to have a house. You don't have to have a whole lot of income for a fancy wedding. Say you can get married and, do it together.
And that's because being together can help you get these goals. I mean, there's no way that I could have gotten through grad school, my wife could have gotten through law school if we hadn't been helping each other out. The same thing with having kids, by the way. There's never a good time to have a kid. You just deal with it when it happens.
It's the idea of marriage being like the capstone to your development, figuring it out, versus something that kind of happens on the path and you and your spouse kind of walk it together.
I mean, I like the idea of premarital counsel. It's like, I don't think it's necessarily a good idea to get a tattoo when you're drunk. And I think if you can sign yourself into a long-term commitment without really possibly being ready, and some people just jumping right to marriage.
In researching this, I learned that your marriage license costs $20 less in West Virginia if you have some kind of premarital counseling. So that's the nudge that we give people. You get a $20 break if you get counseling.
So this is the bigger issue here is the delayed adolescence or the extension of adolescence now. Which I think there is some evidence with more people living at home for longer. People are able to be on their parents' health insurance until they're 25. All these sorts of things seem to argue for people not necessarily starting their life and being independent until now they're mid or late 20s. Here's another example. There's a recent article in the Washington Post about the decline of the teen job. And there are just a lot fewer teenagers working. When I was growing up, I worked a lot. I don't know if you had a job when you were growing up, Lori. What did you do?
I worked at the local newspaper. I did the way that everything was typeset was printed out and you would paste it like it was the old-fashioned way. And so I typeset things and pasted. It was a great job. I loved it. It didn't pay very well at all. But you learn responsibility. You learn, to show up on time, how to work with people, people a different age than you. So, yeah, I think it was great. And I think part of the problem, I will say, this is a very right-wing point to make, but we have this obsession on the left with the living wage. Every wage has to be a living wage. You have to be able to, afford the rent and food and all this. And that's never really been the case with teenage jobs, right? I mean, it's not a living wage. It doesn't have to be a living wage. It's gas money and movie money. And so I think part of the problem is this idea that employers can't pay less than a certain amount, that prices out a lot of teenagers.
My favorite job, by the way, growing up was I was a bean walker. I walked through soybean fields with a big machete and cut weeds out of the way. And I did it for like $4 an hour, which is slightly above minimum wage at the time. To this day, when I think of buying things, I try to translate it. And how many hours of walking through a bean field would it take to buy this? Is it really worth 10 hours in the bean field? But, my daughter, I think she will eventually, get some sort of job. We're going to encourage her to do so. But I could see where there's an argument for not doing it now, which is summers are programmed out. There are all these camps. There are activities they're supposed to do. And during the school year, her academic pressures are so much higher than mine were growing up that she spends just a ton of energy doing her homework. So I think among more middle class, upper middle class families, that's why those teens are less likely to have a job. But it's a loss, right? Having a job teaches you a lot. What do you think, Rick?
Well, when I was at that age, I did a lot of odd jobs for people, and I kept scrupulous tax records on all that, of course, mowing lawns. And I worked as a building houses. It was discovered quickly that I was, my real gift was for carrying shingles to the roof with a ladder, going up a ladder, because I was pretty terrible as a carpenter. But the article actually cited the really positive benefits of a youth employment program in Chicago with reducing violence and things like that. I would like to see more efforts, more policy efforts, creating, you know, socially useful employments that do pay a decent wage, Lori. Sorry, because otherwise you'd undermine the wage floor.
Should a teenager be able to pay the rent and, you know, support a child on, I mean, what's an appropriate wage for a teenager? Should it be different than the minimum wage?
Well, I think that's an issue and an important one. I also think that I don't know if the wage is what's keeping teenagers from getting a job. I think for upper middle class families, it's social pressures. I think for lower income kids, it's just the chaos of their lives, the inability to get to the job.
Educational inequality, discrimination, I mean, all these kind of things.
I've been involved in a couple teen employment programs when I was in Boston over the summers, and they provided all these supports that, you know, made sure the kids got fed, make sure that they got the transportation to get them to the job. You know, it took a little bit of an extra boost. And if I have one soapbox to get on, it's that getting people into work sometimes takes extra effort. But once you get them there, mm-hmm. you know, it leads to success. And I think it's a better investment to get young people into work than it is just to not help them as teenagers and then pay for welfare and other social services when they're unemployed as adults. That's just my thing.
So going back, Lori, you might not hold this person the same degree of reverence as I do, but FDR's idea of the Civilian Conservation Corps, there's a road where I live called Rock Camp, which was actually a CCC camp where you had young people who are actually doing socially useful work and getting some help, getting probably good nutrition for the first time in their lives. And it was a huge thing for people who went through it. I mean, I think something like that on that order, maybe not exactly the same, but brought up to date, would be a really good thing for a lot of communities in the state.
I will
and
say
around
this,
the country.
Though, I do think there is competition between adults in places like West Virginia for like fast food jobs and teens. That's a big thing.
Well, the article mentioned, I was a little bit surprised to see this acknowledged, but there's hard evidence that low-skilled immigration affects the teen employment because it's probably more attractive to have an adult doing the job if there's a low-skilled immigrant who's, you know, willing to work for the wage that you're offering. You might rather take that person over a 16-year-old. And it showed that when there's an economic downturn, the teen employment rate is, you know, unemployment rate just skyrockets. That's kind of the first thing that goes.
Like West Virginia, what you'll see is we don't have immigration, and we might have a really low teen rate. And part of the reason is because we have adults who are willing to do those jobs.
Also, I think this is the other attacking it from a different angle. I think anytime you have a group of working people that you can pay substantially less than others, it lowers the floor for everybody, which is why I support basic standards.
One last thing then, related to growing up, getting jobs, getting educated, married, moving on. We've been doing a series here called The Struggle to Stay. And we've been interviewing different young West Virginians, following them for several months as they're making decisions about staying or going. And I love this one. Mark Combs, who is a veteran, he decided to go. He wants to be an actor/comedian, that sort of guy. And, you know, it's hard to make it here in West Virginia doing that, no matter how well the economy does here. And so he and a friend took off for California. And this is what he thought he would find when he got there.
We don't have jobs lined up.
We don't have jobs lined up. We're going to go out there. We have some people we could crash with for, you know, a few days until we find our own spot.
I think apartments are fairly easy to come by. I think the job market out there is so much larger than what it is here. The jobs are going to be really easy to come by, too. I mean, it is going to take time, and it might take a few days of us being out there. But I don't think we'll run out of money. I mean, I don't foresee it being an issue.
And then a few days later, they pack up their truck. They drive across the country. It's really exciting. And they get there. And then turns out that he has trouble getting an apartment. He has a dog and a cat. And then on top of that, he can't get a job.
He doesn't have an address.
He doesn't have an address. And so this is him a few days later.
So I am homeless, jobless, with $10 accessible to my name. the complete opposite side of the country. I don't really regret the situation that I'm in. I mean, I knew it was going to be hard. I knew it was going to be tough. I'm just, you know, really hoping that we get a break.
There's this myth out there outside of West Virginia and Appalachia. It's just, why don't they leave? And one, a lot of people do leave. But two, what does this story say about people being able to leave and start off someplace else?
You know, listening to that story, it reminded me of the Woody Guthrie song about California is the Garden of Eden, a paradise to live in or to see. But if you don't have the do-re-mi, it's hard to get by there. You got to play that on the way out as we close this episode.
That is a good song. So what it says is it costs money. You need resources to pick up, move, and start someplace else. And a lot of West Virginians don't have them.
Yeah, I don't know that this story convinces me that it's that hard to leave. I mean, look, what you can do to make it easier to leave is go visit the place you want to move to, make sure you can find an apartment, actually find an apartment, and then, I mean, the idea of driving across the country not knowing where you're going to end up, it's very romantic. If it all works out for them, it would be a great story for him to tell when he's a millionaire comedian. But the prudent thing to do would be to plan a little bit better, and then your landing is going to be a little bit softer. And I don't think planning a little bit better than they did would be that difficult.
It reminded me a little bit of, you know, Jack Kerouac's On the Road as far as the cross-country California-Denver thing, although I don't think Sal Paradise traveled with pets, though. I'd have to reread that.
It's a great story. And like I said, you know, you want it to work out,
yeah,
but it's not really surprising that it didn't work out in California.
Well, and so you can hear the next installment on Inside Appalachia, download it as a podcast or check it out on West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Last we heard from them there in Denver, and that's where the story will pick up next week. Part of the issue, though, is that it's hard for a middle-class person to realize how someone who has literally no safety net might have trouble even doing what you're saying.
Even visiting
could be hard. And so I do think, though, that L.A. was, how can I say, it's not the typical destination of a West Virginian.
Sure. You can't visit L.A., but you can visit Columbus.
You could visit Columbus. You could go to Charlotte. And most people also look for family members that have gone before them. One of the problems I think that Mark and his friend found out is that friends say they want to help you, but sometimes they're just not as able to let you stay on their couch for 3 or 4 weeks. You know, it's a lot to ask.
Well, like pet policy was one thing that kept him from getting a place.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, would you leave?
I'd be like the Joads. I'd be like the Joads, you know, packing up everybody on the truck. That reminds me of a Soviet Union story, by the way, when they wanted to show the Grapes of Wrath movie in the Soviet Union because in 1940 or something, because they thought it'd be a good way of showing the oppression in the United States, and they stopped right away because what everybody saw was, oh my God, poor people have cars over there.
All right, you already did your Bible verse.
Another one is, there was famine in the land, so Abraham went down to Egypt to sojourn there. That's like in the Bible, there's two images of where you go, exile. One is where you go for a good gig to look for a better life, and that's Egypt, although it doesn't always work out long term. It's the Exodus story. And then there's Babylon, which is a place where you kind of go involuntarily, you know.
So when you say, I'm going to stay in West Virginia, despite the fact that I could make a lot more money and advance in my career if I went to someplace else, is that, Rick, a countercultural? Is that why people sometimes don't respect us here in West Virginia, because we're deciding to pass up on the American dream, which is you do better for yourself materially, you pass on that material wealth to your children, they do better for themselves. Staying here is almost like saying I'm opting out of part of that dream because I value community or family.
I mean, I was really felt the pressure for a long time. I was tempted to go somewhere else, but I made a decision and I'm going to stay here and do what I can to try to make it better.
You tweeted an article about an older woman who baked bread for her neighbors. They took the bread and then never said boo to her again, basically. And this is in Southern California, right? Well, why did you tweet that?
It really struck me. What struck me was how cruel we can be as a society to our older people in a way. I mean, because I forget how old she was. I think maybe
70.
In her 70s. And here she's like constantly reaching out to people. It wasn't just baking bread. She, you know, had a coffee klatch at her house and put flyers up. And like six people came and they didn't eat her food. They just drank the tea and kind of sat there and left, and she never saw them again. So she
didn't ask about her life at all.
Right. She's trying to create community, and, you know, people are just completely like not having any of it. And I guess, you know, I wondered, is it Southern California? Is it some, 'cause here in the neighborhood I live in, people would love that. People would be a lot more receptive to that. And I know my neighbors, and we don't just wave in the driveway. We have actual relationships. And but I felt terrible for her and for people like her.
I think it's partly Southern California, and I think it's also partly the times we live in. As she was saying, that in her past, you know, even in where she lived in the past, things were better.
I think a big thing in Appalachia and a lot of older traditional cultures is hospitality, you know, which I think that is a huge thing. It's what the whole Trojan War was fought about, you know. So, yeah, to go there to someone's place and not show the respect for that, or to be a bad guest or a bad host is a real violation.
I think that's partly generational, too. I think, you know, if you're under maybe 50, you just don't have that ingrained sense that, like, if someone invites you into their home, you're going to reciprocate, or if they bake your bread, you're going to reciprocate somehow.
You're right, I think. And we'll see how things like the opioid epidemic, for example, how will those stresses affect Appalachian culture? But it's a strong culture, and part of it is respect for the elderly, and part of it is this idea that you know people as people and not just, you know, as professional acquaintances.
Transactional. We're more relational than transactional, I would say.
Exactly. Exactly. Why is that, by the way? Do you know?
I think it's the way you survive here. If you're going to last, you have to be. And also, if you don't see the same people over and over again, there's less incentive to cooperate, like we talked about on the one episode.
So maybe those are the trade-offs. I don't think you get to have both. I don't think you get to have the maximum amount of social mobility and material wealth and a strong sense of community. I think you have to make choices. Well, that's the Front Porch for this week. I'm Scott Finn, Executive Director of West Virginia Public Broadcasting. I am joined by Lori Lynn, our conservative columnist and lawyer, and Rick Wilson of the American Friends Service Committee, liberal hillbilly
and
philosopher.
A champion of working families, Lori.
We are all champions of working families.
See you next week.
Police at the port of entry say, you're number 14,000 for today. And if you ain't got the do-re-mi, boy, if you ain't got the do-re-mi, you better go back to your beautiful Texas, Oklahoma, Kansas, Georgia, Tennessee.